I would like to talk with you in perhaps a very informal way this afternoon on a subject that I'm going to announce in about 10, 15 minutes. My introduction... I'm just deciding on what to call it. My introduction is longer than the content of the talk. So this is, of course, a case in which the tail is going to wag the dog. Now, I suppose when anyone ever is known as a psychologist, people start kind of looking at them over their glasses, you know, and saying, I wonder what's wrong with that guy and all this stuff. And I've been almost isolated since I've been here because I think people, the word gets around, if they're seen with me, they've got a problem. So let me tell you, I'm very lonely. I would like to just say this much by way of personal introduction. I'm married and have two children. One in the Air Force, happens to be a boy. One girl in her second year of nurse's training. I was a child bridegroom, incidentally. As our good friend here before me has said, our work is involved in Oklahoma City. It's a matter of directing the Highland Counseling Center. This is a psychological counseling and testing center, a clinic there in the city. And actually, the foundation of this rests upon the fact that there's no real discrepancy between true psychology and true religion. And we've sought to gather around us some of the very finest men professionally in the field of medicine, psychiatry, psychology, who are all, incidentally, professed Christians, know the Lord, and this was one of the basic requirements along with their professional skills. And we're in the third year of operation there. I think possibly I should mention this, that our basic approach along this line involves not only psychology, but theology and philosophy. In my own personal preparation, I finished out degrees in these other fields. I should say I'm in the process of finishing out one in a doctoral degree in philosophy right now from the University of Oklahoma. It's my conviction that you have to come at this problem of dealing with people from several angles. And the real final answers aren't in the area of psychology, but are actually in the area of theology. And also it certainly helps one to have a little philosophy thrown in. I've noted that too many times with men that I have dealt with, psychiatrists, psychologists, medical doctors, and so forth, that their training has been so limited and constricted. They don't even know the nomenclature or the terminology of, say, the field of theology. They don't even know what you're talking about when you start talking in this field or in philosophy. And I feel that too many times we drill deeply in one area and have no breadth whatsoever. And consequently, we cannot orient ourselves to life. And so our whole approach there in the city and in the clinic, encompasses not just the field of psychology, but it also includes theology, and I hope philosophy to some extent. Now, most of all, if I have any credentials at all that would be worth considering, it would be the fact that I, like you, happen to be a child of the King. We love the Lord Jesus Christ, and we personally know Him as our Savior. And to me, this is the greatest thing anyone can say in reference to themselves, to humbly claim kinship, brothers and sisters in the Lord. Now, as I said, there's several things I'd like to say by way of introduction so that you'll understand a little bit more fully as to what we're going to say later. Now, I mentioned these three fields, theology, philosophy, psychology. Now, I've noticed a lot of fellows, even some Christian men, who oftentimes some that we trained with in our schooling, who missed the boat somewhere along the line and went over the deep end. And usually it comes at a very simple point. They exchange for their basic approach, instead of putting theology, making it basic, what they know of God through His Word. Instead of making it basic, they'll make it secondary. They'll put psychology here, philosophy here, they'll put anthropology here, just any ology you want to put here, and seek to interpret their religion from the standpoint of these particular areas of knowledge. And the simple thing I have found all along, if I just keep my theology basic, my experience with God basic, my individual personal knowledge of Him basic, and seek to interpret all of these other areas according to my religious views, then things certainly fall in place properly. Granted, there are questions that come up quite often that it might appear as if there's a contradiction involved here, say, between psychology and theology. But I found without fail that in those cases, all of the facts are not in. And if you're patient enough to keep some things in abeyance until you can examine them thoroughly, it puts you in good stead, always. I don't think that there is ever any contradiction within the whole total realm of truth. Wherever we find it, it fits together like this. Because God is the author of it. And as Skip said this morning, if I am allowed to quote eminent men in the field, as he said, that all truth is an extension of the character of God. Did I say it right, Skip? All right. And Christ himself said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. I think perhaps the most significant attitude one might ever take in life is in regard to the truth. Do you really want to know it? And in knowing it, do you want to handle it properly? Do you want to follow its dictates? If you follow the truth, it'll lead you to Christ, because as he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. So keep your theology basic. You'll never be sorry. The boat won't be rocked if you do this. Now, I suppose there are several avenues to the truth. May I suggest four, just briefly here? I think reason is one avenue which will lead us to the truth as we earnestly seek it. I think this is perhaps a compliment to God. He made us with a brain. What reasoning we have, what understanding we have is a gift of God, cultivated perhaps by ourselves. Reason is one approach. This is the approach the philosopher takes, the mathematician. 2 + 2 = 4. Then the second approach to truth, we might just list experience. It's technically called the empirical method, which the scientist takes. The scientist will set up his experiment. He will make observations. Of course, he starts out with a hypothesis and so forth. If he can run an experiment and it can be verified by following experiments of the same type and use what is called the scientific method, oftentimes he can reach truth, perhaps scientific truth. His method is through experience, through observation, and so forth. There's a third avenue to truth we'll call intuition. This is the route of the mystic, the individual who has a first-hand confrontation with truth or with God. It's a first-hand knowledge, an inner persuasion that this is it. There may be no reason to it, but it's there. And we don't want to, certainly we do not want to undersell the importance of intuition properly conceived. The fourth avenue to truth that I'm listing is revelation. We call this the revelatory approach to truth. God has spoken. He's spoken perhaps in many ways through nature, through the Holy Spirit now. He speaks through, in times gone by, I think the book of Hebrews, the writer there said, God who at sundry times and in divers manners, spoke to the prophets and all. He used many approaches. He has in these last days, through his Son. You can tell I'm not a navigator. I'd have quoted that and given you the chapter and verse. I did do this much. I looked up the crummiest looking Bible I could find at home, the one that looked like it had the most wear to impress all you folks when I came out. See, I know some of the tricks to the trade too. All right, now. Through revelation. Now, I'm not listing it on the same par with these other three. I think it's basic. I think if necessary, it'll stand by itself, sufficient and adequate within itself. However, I think these other three avenues could be listed perhaps as corroborating, assuring, supplemental avenues to the truth. And in my own way of thinking, I would say that if a thing is true, it will check out in all four areas. It'll check out in all four areas. It will present itself as that being reasonable. Come, let us reason together, saith the Lord. Reasonableness, experience, it'll check out right. I think truth will work. Truth ultimately works. If not in this world, in the world to come. I mean, God doesn't pay off every Saturday night. And just because things results do not follow certain causes always and immediately, we may think, well, this guy's getting by. But no one's getting by with anything. This is the exact truth there. And ultimately, it'll all come out in the wash, right. This universe is stacked in favor of God and right and truth, ultimately. You can't win if you bow your neck and set your head against Him. So this business of reason, experience, and then intuition, it just sounds right. You know, it said that the common people heard Jesus gladly. It was the difference in His speaking and the scribes who said what to do and didn't do it, as it would be the difference in the sound of a plug nickel and a real nickel if you dropped them. When it had the right ring to it, people said, you know, that's just the way I've felt all along it ought to be. It had this is sort of an intuitive something here, a first-hand grasp of that which is true. So these are just four that I suggest. There may be other avenues, but I think that if a thing is true, it will check out according to Revelation. It'll first of all line up with God's Word, and it will not ultimately defy any of these other three areas. Now, if you take a position in the Bible and say, now this is it, and it doesn't check out on some of these other areas, how does it line up with the experience of good godly men down through the ages of the Christian church, say? Experience. Over in, I believe it's in Deuteronomy 12 or 11 it is, Moses relates in his farewell message a whole string of things. He said, remember this, 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 and all these things God has done for you. In other words, he's appealing to experience. You've experienced certain things with God. He took you through the Red Sea and so forth. So you see, this is an avenue to the truth here. Experience, reason, intuition, and revelation. Now, I find many people, and usually one of the first things I ask a person to do when they come to our clinic, when we have, say, the initial interview, I ask them to define for me very simply in one sentence, if not more than two, precisely what they think is wrong. It may have many facets to it, but I want it crystallized. I want them to put their finger on what they say, well, after all, this is the basic problem as I see it. Now, they may be wrong, but it is significant to know how they feel, because we react according to the way we think and feel, whether we're thinking correctly or not. And so it's important to know what they think and how they feel about it. Now, after setting forth this point, we go into developing a case history and all that, you know. Well, the point I'm trying to make is this, that too many people are not able to, or they do not distinguish between cause and effect, or disease and symptom. They'll forever think that a symptom is the disease, or it's the cause, the effect is the cause. They say, well, this is my problem. Maybe it's kind of like someone coming to a doctor and saying, boy, I'm nervous, I'm just shaking like this. Give me something for my nerves. So he will prescribe, say, some tranquilization, and take the pills, and 30, 40 minutes, you feel just almost go to sleep, this kind of thing. Well, what has happened there? He has treated a symptom, not a cause, not the disease. What we really want to know is, why is this person nervous? What's chewing on them? What's wrong? What goes here? And oftentimes they really don't know themselves, but 9 times out of 10 they'll come up with symptoms rather than real causes. And this is another introductory point here. About the time it's time to close, I'll still be in my introduction, looks like. So, distinguishing between these two are very important. Now, I'm going to give you a few principles here quickly in capsule form to keep in mind as we think together about spiritual and mental health here. And I haven't announced my subject yet. I think I will as soon as I see what the content's going to be. I've got, let's see, 6 things I've jotted down here. Principles to keep in mind in reference to thinking about mental health and what's good or what's bad for you and so forth. Number one is perspective. This is seeing things in their proper relationship. This is a common problem. People can't grasp some way or other. They let little things look like they're big, and big things appear little. and in their whole system of values, they'll see invaluable things as valuable and all. They do not see broadly enough. This, it's just as important to have breadth as it is to have depth in a field. This is the trouble with many experts and many people who have specialized in certain areas. They have no breadth. If you're going to run a footing under a foundation, say for a house or a building, it's as important to have that as broad in width as it ought to be, as well as deep as it ought to be in depth, because if you don't, with the pressure of the roof and the walls, it'll tend to give it this. And you have to have it broad enough to have a pontoon effect so that footing won't shift. So it's highly important to have breadth along with depth. Now, this is, to me, a very fine safeguard in this whole field of psychology. This is one reason I've taken the approach that I have. You need to know, first of all, what the good Lord has to say about it. This is our teeing off spot. It's good to know what the wise men of the ages, philosophically, what their reasoning has been. It's good to know what perhaps those who are studying the behavior of mankind in psychology have said. One can check out against another quickly here. Perspective is one. See the thing in perspective. Balance is another. This is the overall matter of proper proportion. Too many people have gone over the deep end, religiously and otherwise, because they have not maintained the right kind of balance. You need to pray, you need to read the Word, you need to memorize some, but you need to play, you need to socialize some. You need a good, well-balanced life. This is your greatest, this is the greatest factor to keep you from becoming imbalanced in a certain area or unbalanced. You need to keep these proportions right. And if you don't, you're going to suffer in the long run. If you take needed accent off of one area in order to put it on something else and really ride a hobby, remember that this is a very poor thing. And usually concentration in one area without proper safeguards of breadth leads to disaster. I've dealt with too many good people, Christian people who have done this. Some who've said, I'm just going to pray. I'm going to just read God's Word, nothing else. Or I'm going to do this or do that. It's not that it's not good to do these things, but you can become foundered even on something good. My wife is a farm girl, or was a farm girl, and I rescued her from the farm. I'm not too sure of what had been best if we'd both gone back to the farm. But anyway, I remember one Sunday, her father was a Sunday school superintendent in our home church. And they came home. He had some very fine dairy cows. And went home from church one Sunday and found, five or six of them just dead. Well, what had happened? They'd gotten into some real good grain while they were at Sunday school and church that morning. They'd foundered themselves and they were dead. Something good, but it's too much of it. See? And so, quality isn't the only consideration on this. Quantity, timing, and a lot of things are to be considered. Perspective, balance, accent. This is the point of emphasis, the point of priority. What do you put first, second, and third in your life, and so forth? Another one is variety. This indicates change. You need a change. This is one reason I'm up here. I'm just up to here with dealing with the problems of people back yonder. And so I had to get out here. You know the adage, physician, heal thyself. Well, I had to make tracks out here. Maybe they'd have to treat me. We always think we're the exception to the rule, but we're not. This is where we goof up sometimes. Variety, another one. Depth and breadth. I put those two things together. Depth and breadth. And the last one, reserve. This is the margin of safety from which you're operating. Are you operating from a point of weakness or a point of strength? I remember one man I heard speak one time, a very able public speaker, capable. He said, you ought to know 10 times more about the subject you're talking than what you have time to give. In other words, people will sense you're speaking from a reserve, from a point of strength, not a point of weakness, not a point of shallowness. Reserve. Now, are you just living by a shoestring? Breath. In other words, do you just barely get enough sleep? Do you just barely eat as much as you ought? Or do you just barely get out and get enough sunshine and fresh air? Do you ever cut the monotony of the schedule here and completely get out of this place? Not that it's not good, but you need to clear out once in a while. This is good mental therapy. You need a change at this point once in a while. And so if you don't, if you're just barely skimming by the skin of your teeth. Just barely made it without a nervous breakdown. Oh, just barely made it. I almost told somebody off, you know, and almost gave them a piece of my mind. You know, if you really have spiritual reserve, some temptations aren't very difficult to handle at all. But if you're just barely getting by on quiet time, no, these things may loom up as great big giants to you. So you need to operate not only on a spiritual reserve, but a mental reserve. Don't push yourself to the breaking point. This is foolish. In fact, it's just right, downright stupid. Whatever that word means. Now, another part of my introduction. I've had a growing concern for Christians over a period of time who have been freighted and laden with many problems. Now, it doesn't mean that you're going to have fewer problems naturally as being a Christian, but you may have more. You have annexed perhaps a whole new sphere of problems. Here you've been working along with Satan, the devil. Now he's your enemy. Well, that's something to take into account, to reckon with. If you don't believe it, just try it. You may have problems you've never thought you could have after you've become a Christian. Granted, you have made a basic adjustment with God, which is perhaps one of the finest things you can do to help all the rest of your activities and relationships in life to stack up right. You can't really be very well related to yourself until you know where you stand with God and being related to Him or with others, see. Well, now, I say I have a growing concern because, after all, as Christians, we have a body with which we have to control. We have a spirit to nourish. We have a mind to keep balanced. We have pressures to equalize, responsibilities to shoulder, a life to manage, people to please, expectations and deadlines to meet, fears, frustrations, disillusionments to handle, infirmities to bear, and a God from whom to gain approval. That's a 24-hour-a-day job, or I'd say a 25-hour-a-day job. You have to crowd that many of them in once in a while. But actually, you see, it's a wonder any of us made it up to now. It's only by the grace of God and exercising all the strength and grace and good sense we've got that we just hold ourselves together these days. The life hid with Christ in God, the life of love, has a... well, what would you call it? A centripetal force pulling in. It integrates. It holds together. It glues, helps glue you together. Whereas a life in sin has a strong centrifugal force that just, you just are going to be fragmented and scattered in a dozen different directions if you're not careful. You'll feel like you're just being pulled apart. There's no center like we have in a Christian life. So now we have a real task in facing up to life. So we need two things. We need a good working understanding of ourselves. That's point one. I don't want to minimize that. Point two, we need all the available help from God. This, in effect, brings about a joint effort. This is what Christian living really is. And I heard someone preach one time, years ago, a young fellow, on the 50-50 gospel. I thought, what in the world is he going to preach on now? And so he went through a number of promises. If you do this, I'll do that. If we confess our sins, He's faithful and just to forgive us our sins. If we draw nigh to God, He'll draw nigh to us. The co-labor effect here. And so, as Socrates said a good many years ago, know thyself. This is point one. And as I'm sure all of us would say, we need to know God. This is the second aspect of this. Now, that's the finish of my introduction. And I think by now, we've come to this point. The remainder of this brief session, and I'm talking rapidly on purpose to get as much in as I can, I want to discuss a few questions with you pertaining to self-understanding. I'm choosing this first one because it's so often neglected. You expect people here to emphasize the spiritual, the religious, and rightly so. But I think sometimes we do it to the neglect of coming to a good understanding of ourselves. One of the frequent statements I hear people make to me after maybe two or three, four or five sessions, they'll, after we go through a lot of the preliminaries, you know, and all of this, we work through many things that seem to be problems but are just symptoms, they'll finally settle down in their seat and they'll say, well, I guess my main problem after all is I just don't know who... Well, hit it at the right time, didn't I? I just don't know who I am. That sounds stupid, doesn't it? Who am I? Some lady saw me the other day. I didn't have this name tag on. I hate to tell you what I did. One morning I got up over here and put my wife's name tag on. Her name is Marvella, the first name. And I was wearing it around over here. And she finally came and said, "What in the world are you doing with my name tag?" And I said, looked at him, and lo and behold, I had her name tag on. I'd met a few new people, and one of these guys kind of sidled around to me after he heard her say that. He said, "Well, I thought that was kind of a funny name for a man, but I didn't say anything." You know, just... You can only take so much of this kind of work. Who am I? So there's a lady who said to me at the evening meal, I didn't have the name tag on. She said, "Well, you don't even know who you are." And I said, "Do you mean to assume that if I had a tag on here with my name on it, I'd still really know who I was?" And so this is the point I'm trying to bring out. Who really are you? Three questions, and these are the three. I may not get to the third one. I'll get to the first two, I hope. Who am I? And secondly, how do I react? And why? The third one is, wherein lies help? See, I'll just bring you right up to here and then just cut you off. You don't have any help here. But who am I is number one, and how do I react is question number two. I'm sure that it would go without saying almost that if we're going to give just a definition of a person, we'd say you're a spirit created in the image of God, capable of becoming more and more like Him, the possibility of development and so forth. But I'm going to draw now a few simple, almost oversimplified, I don't know what to call them. These are original with me, and I'm sure I wouldn't even have to label them. If I painted a picture, I'd have to label it and say, "This is a cow." But these here, I think they'll perhaps get through to you a little bit more quickly than if I would write. So in answer to this question, who am I, I'm going to draw a couple little symbols here. There you are. Some are a little more this way than that way. But Now, I don't know what this might do to some of your theology, but I want you to think. Most of this I'm just throwing out for you as a suggestion to sort of stimulate you. I don't even care if you agree or don't agree with me, but if you just think on your own, it'll help. In theology, one of the big problems all down through the ages has been the fact that theologians have not distinguished between two simple things. One is essence and one is function. You get a little bit more of this in philosophy than you do theology. An essence is a something. If I were going to say, what are you or who am I, I would say, first of all, I am a spirit or spirit. I'm made in the image of God. And so spirit, I've indicated this is the area right here of spirit, see, right? Now this is the stuff of what you are, of what you are made. You are basically spirit. And you're a person. We could use some synonyms, person, self, ego. But spirit is what you are. You're one. You're an integrated unit. You don't act like a mind and a body and a spirit. Spiritually, we can't break man up arbitrarily. We try it. In theology, we used to have the trichotomy viewpoint and the dichotomy viewpoint. Man is body and spirit, or body, mind, and spirit. But what happens in those is that you get confused at the point of essence and function. Now, the essence of man is spirit. This is spirit right here. Now, the function of this spirit is a different thing completely. He feels, I put E here, emotions, I feel. The intellect, I think. I will, this is the volitional part, I will, I can make decisions. I'm a self-determining type person. Now all of these things I've mentioned here are functions, activities. It doesn't even have a thing to do with essence of what you are as a person. The essence of man is spirit. The functions of this spirit are these three that I've mentioned. Now, this spirit dwells in a body. I think that's scriptural. In fact, those two are so intricately interwoven, the spirit permeating the body, that if you would forcefully pull them apart, death takes place. Spirit returns to the maker, the body to the ground. In fact, the body is not an integral part of man. For example, I feel sort of ornery doing this, but I'm going to call the scriptures to bear on this now, because I know this is authority with you, and it ought to be. For example, in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, two died. After death, here the bodies of both men were in the grave, but here we find the man, say the rich man and Lazarus, let's see, it's Lazarus and what's it? I'll get my story straight in a minute. Yeah, it's the rich man and Lazarus. And so the rich man is in Hades and he's feeling all this torment and he sees Lazarus in the bosom of Abraham and so forth. Well, now this rich man can think, he can remember, he can pray. He has all of these powers about him that are centered actually in the brain. This is the meaty piece up here in the skull. The mind is the functioning of this piece of our anatomy. But what I'm trying to say is that after death, after the body had been separated from the spirit still had all of the functioning power of a complete man. Now, the body certainly is the temple of the Holy Spirit. It is a vehicle through which the spirit can operate in this earthly sphere as it ought. We're going to have a new body one of these days, a resurrected body. But all I'm saying is that the three functions of man, this matter, feeling, thinking, and willing, and every act we do participates. Well, I should say it partakes of these three functions. For example, if you hear the alarm clock early in the morning, you're supposed to get up for your quiet time. And it takes just all the willpower you've got to get up. I'd say that that act probably has about 90% will in it. And probably 2% feeling. If you went according to feeling, oh, you'd stay in bed. And maybe 3% intellect. You see what I'm getting at? Now, they all participate every action has so much of these in it. Now, I might just quickly add this. In a person who is well-adjusted, who is sane, all of these three functions center in the spirit here. And I'm going to call these mental functions. Now, not just the mind as such, but totally conceived. In a broad sense, any function, say, of the spirit, I'm going to term just mental function at this point. And so, when all of these functions converge here, sort of a central switchboard, we comprehend a certain thought, and then we react in a given way, in an appropriate way. But now, if a person, say, like in a schizophrenic reaction, or one that is quite disturbed, we find that these functions like this are goofed up. They don't converge. Here's the spirit here. So, for example, through the mind, we receive a message, our dear old sweet mother has passed away. All right, comes to this, the center here of our being. And the reaction, emotional we have, maybe we will, if we're mentally unbalanced, we may just go into convulsive laughter. My dear old sweet mother's passed away. Ha, 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 ha. Well, you see, that's an inappropriate reaction. So we say that inappropriateness is one symptom of the schizophrenic reaction. In other words, when these are not integrated, your feelings, your thinking, and your willing, we say that mental illness is set in here. The fellow's kind of falling apart, coming apart at the seams, see. And you'll get one stimulus, and you get the wrong reaction. And so it's kind of like an operator at a PBX getting one call and putting the plug in at the wrong places. Here you've got the wrong people with the right folks, see. So forth. Now, just basically, I'd say that man is primarily spirit. It's not dichotomy, trichotomy. I'd say monocotomy, but that's a misnomer because mono means one and cotomy means more than one, so I can't put those together. It's sort of a monism here. He's a unit. God is one. And from this, we have several functions. Now, if you take the trichotomy view, body, mind, and spirit, you have body and spirit. Those are, let's say, body, mind, and spirit. Those are two essences. Mind is a function. You're not dividing up the right things here, see. Well, so much for that. I'm not saying you have to believe any of this. I'm just throwing it out and letting you think on it. Now, another thing, in answering the question, who am I? We bring to every situation a total past. It colors our view. And there's no such thing as perfect objectivity. So, if I could quickly just go down this line now a minute. If this would sort of be a case history of our behavior, why we do what we do. And this may help us to identify who we are. On this first level here, I'm going to try to make a pyramid. I'm going to put heredity. I'm just going to abbreviate these words. I don't know if that's her. Put him over here. Heredity. Environmental circumstances. The second one is environmental circumstances. The third one would be individual experiences. The next one would be concepts. Running out of think ahead. Okay. This one here is attitudes. This one up here would say action or acts. Now you know the old saw about an iceberg being 6/7 of the berg submerged and only 1/7 of it above the water line. Well, this is about the way all of our actions are. When we see someone do something wrong, we say, well, why did that guy do so-and-so? Talking to someone else, say, well, have you ever noticed his attitude? That's the reason he's got the wrong attitude. We say, well, why does he have the wrong attitude? Well, have you ever heard what he believes or what he thinks, what his concepts, his views, his philosophy of life is? That's why he feels as he does. Well, where in the world did he ever get these ideas, these concepts? Well, if you'd come from the family he'd come from, if you'd been where he'd been, if you'd had the experiences he had come through, if things had happened to you like they have in his life, you'd probably had the same views. See? So what I'm getting at is this, in trying to change this, I might say, now, Joe Blow, don't do that. You're goofing up, man. Don't do that anymore. So Joe Blow may not do it because I say so. He doesn't gain any insight into the why. So there wouldn't be much motivation. But we usually have to get right back down to about here, at least, to really help a person. For example, someone who has a failure complex. Everything turns to water. They never can do anything right. They just hex everything up. And they're a jinx. You just better not have them around in any program or any planning that you have. So I can't say, boy, you're a success. Go to it. You can make it. I'm for you. Rah, rah, rah. Well, this won't help them much. But if I can get back here and help them to have some kind of a real success experience, even one, where they can see that things can be different, then they start getting the idea, well, I maybe change my mind. I don't have to fail all the time. And then their attitude starts changing. I think of an attitude as a concept plus, say, a feeling. You not only have an idea here, but you have a feeling. And out of this, then, stems the right action, finally, where he starts maybe succeeding occasionally. Now, usually, you have to get your thinking straightened out on this level here before your feelings will change or your actions will change. This is important. People feel wrong oftentimes because they think wrong. If I have the concept of God that he's a big monster with a club ready to clobber me, I don't want to find out who he is any more than that. I'm going to stay away from him. My feeling toward him, my attitude toward him is regulated by my concept, my idea of him, see. So a lot of people feel wrong because they don't have the right facts. They don't have the right concept within their mind. Sometimes it's vice versa. Sort of an interaction. Sometimes you can feel wrong about something and consequently think wrong about it because the feeling content is so strong. Now, I might say, put this one up here. This is a far out. All you see beers and antenna men, hams and the like, here's an antenna up there. It doesn't look like it's at the right perspective. I never did have art, but, well, anyway, okay. Now let's see here. Suppose, now this is one individual, and all that you do and think, really it has a history here. Coming back here to heredity, your home environment, the experiences you've had and all. Now, every time you say something or do something or assess a certain thing, you're trying to communicate with somebody else. Well, here we have another iceberg over here, some literal of that. Well, here's an iceberg here. There are antenna up here, and you're trying to make contact with them. And everything you say, it's... You see it from your viewpoint. You know, some people say, well, now, in my opinion, well, for goodness sake, whose else opinion could they give? I mean, you can only see it through your eyes. There's no such thing as real objectivity. And so, what I'm saying is this. You can say one thing here, and somebody else over here can pick up the same word, but the meaning, the connotation of what you've said is altogether different. Maybe if you say, home. Well, to some that might recall mother, my old dog, friends, plenty of money. Just name it. No restrictions. This fellow came from that background. He says, home. This guy over here, he hears the word home. Home? Oh, brother. Drunk, fights, divorce, heartache, sorrow. Do you see what I'm getting at? Here's the problem of communication. Really, we're speaking from two different worlds, really. And we have to keep this in mind. So I'm going to leave that right there. My second question is how... How do I react? How do I react? Give you a little definition here of emotions first. Emotions, this is the interaction of the spirit and the body. You remember when I had the two here? The spirit interacting with the body. It's contained within the body. And however we feel physically certainly affects us spiritually. And how the tone of our lives spiritually can affect us physically. I mean, there's an interaction here all the time. So our emotions actually stem from this. I think physically and organically, our emotions are built right on the endocrine glandular system. Oh, the thyroid, parathyroid, pituitary, it's about 8 or 10 of these glands. They secrete hormones into the bloodstream. The blood has to maintain a real fine chemical balance. If it doesn't, you've had it. We can see different areas in life. Say, the reason teenagers act like they do. They don't know whether they're going to climb a flagpole or do this or that. Well, they're... Things are surging on the inside. They're maturing. And these glands and the secretion of the glands, the hormonal secretion into the bloodstream is such that they don't know whether they're coming or going. They're this way. Well, now, I dare say if your glands were doing the same, you'd be acting like a teenager, even though you're 50. If anybody hears that age, or 40 or 30. I'll get down to your level pretty soon. 20. All I'm saying is that our emotional system is built right on this glandular system. And when we find a disturbance glandularly, we find a comparable disturbance emotionally. Now, a lot of things that people call spiritual problems are nothing but glandular problems. Just put it down. And we're not being irreligious by saying it. It's just the flat truth. Now, I'm not trying to beg the question and say that all that you do and all the blowing off you do that's wrong and everything else, the sin that you commit is just because of your glands. I'd say it's because of your will, and your glands maybe too. But God can work through your will if you'll cooperate with Him to a fine point of control. But all I'm saying here is that emotions stem from both directions. Certainly the spirit of the person, his will, what he has to say and do, and what he thinks and how he conceives certain things. But also from the body, it's an interacting proposition. And if you do not make that line of demarcation, you'll be forever confused, spiritually as well as mentally in a sense. And so this is just a distinction I'm drawing here. Now, coming down to this matter of emotions, quickly, about how do I react... And you understand I'm covering a lot of territory pretty in a shallow way here this afternoon. Now, why do I react like I do and so forth? Now, here's another homemade one. And we're going to label this. I've put a C here. This means conflicts. Maybe 1,001 different conflicts. This is the seedbed out of which tension rises. And so we'll make a point here and we'll call this T. This is tension. All of these conflicts, what people expect of me and what I can do. What I'd like to look like and what I really look like. And what I need financially and what I've got. What my mother-in-law expects of me and what I can produce. You know, all this. There's a million different conflicts. What the Lord expects of me and what I know I'm doing. I mean, my level of production compared with what it ought to be. This kind of difference, this lag here in all of these things create conflicts within. Conflicts create tension. All right, now, tension is to the mind what temperature is to the body. If we're running above 98.6, we say, oh, got some infection. Something's wrong somewhere in Denmark. Okay, so temperature is to the body what tension is to the mind. Now, we all operate under 98.6. This is healthy. You're supposed to operate under a degree of temperature, see. You're supposed to operate under certain degrees of tension, too. Say, tension goalward. You can set goals. You can strive. You can plan and organize. This is good, up to a point if you don't overdo it. So, but if you get too much, we say, uh-oh, something's wrong here. So when we get a lot of conflicts bearing in here on us, now most of us can take these conflicts pretty well if you don't get too many of them, maybe one at a time, but if you get a dozen of them converging on you at once, you say, boy, your head goes under. You say, I can't take it. Too much tension, what do we want to do? We want to resolve this tension. We don't like it. We want to get out from under it. There's a number of ways I suppose you can resolve tension. People seek to resolve tension. One is to withdraw. Say, I don't like this rat race. The rats are going to win anyway. I'm just going to withdraw and withhold my wonderful self from everybody. This is one way to fight. I think this, some women fight this way. They say, well, just withhold my wonderful self from you. Well, this is, okay, withdraw. Now, the opposite end of this would be aggression. We'll put it down here. A-G-G. Become aggressive. You've seen people who think, well, boy, I'm just under it. This world's just a battle and a struggle. I've got to just fight, and have a chip on the shoulder. Everything comes in the category of a fight. I've seen some people just make a fight out of everything. Well, they're fighting their way through. They're struggling, see. Then there is two other ways, I suppose, that we could mention, at least two other ways here. One, we can be evasive. This is the next step from withdrawal, actually. Be evasive. Escape. Elude the situation. The next, we could accommodate ourselves to it. If you can't beat them, join them. Accommodate to the situation at hand. This is one way to do it. And there's only really one basically good, healthy, mentally healthy way to do it, and that's to face reality. So now let's see what there is here. Don't run from it. And then do your utmost with the help of God to handle the situation. Do your best. That's all even a horse can do. So why load yourself down with a lot of guilt if you can't do any more than that? So you might look back over in these conflicts and say, now, there's some things I can resolve, some I can't. It's a very good point of mental health to know what you can settle and what you can't. No need to worry the rest of your life because your eyes are blue. Well, my illustration breaks down. They even have, what are these things put in there? Now that you can change the color of your eye and your hair and everything else. Well, you can't help it that you're 6 foot or 3 foot or 5 foot or four. No need to lie awake at night and try to add one cubit to your stature by stretching yourself or anything else. The things that you can change, fine, work on them. The things you can't, have enough sense to leave them settled. I'm not going to lie awake at night and worry because the good Lord didn't see fit to make me 6 foot two and tall, dark and handsome and black wavy hair and all that stuff. I'm ruined. The Lord might near ruin me. But I'm not going to worry about it. I'm just going to do the best I can with what I've got. It's his fault, not mine. Now, there are several levels of interaction. I want to end with this today. I'm not going to get to that third question. And this is really where a match strikes some fire. Okay. I'm going to name this Levels of Interaction. Levels of interaction. This is why I do what I do. So forth. Let's see. All right. Now, that which you are before you are anything else. Well, that's a good one, isn't it? That which I am before I am anything else is I am a person. I am a soul, a spirit. This is before I'm a man or a woman. Now, if you want to get to the lowest common denominator, say in this country we have, what, about 195 million people, and it's pretty evenly divided. I think maybe a few more women than men, but they've got to be submissive to all of us. Okay, I'd hate for them to get the upper hand after we treated them the way we have. Okay, the lowest common denominator isn't whether or not you're a man or a woman, male or female. It is the fact that you're a person. We have 195 million persons in this country. Now the next step up would be we have, say, approximately... Now, what in the world's half of 195? That would be 97 and a half. Would that be right? Okay, 97 and a half million women and 97 and a half million men. You see, this is just one step removed from the lowest common denominator. So I would say on this level of interaction, the most basic, it's person to person. Person to person. Now, for example... The important thing is not whether you're a man or a woman if it comes to the point of integrity and honesty. If I'm dealing with somebody going to buy a car, whether it's a man selling it to me or a woman, I want that person to be a person of integrity and honest. So this is what we are before we're even anything else on the gender line. And so we react with each other person to person. See, now there are two or three things that are important here. Number one is the quality of the person. The quality of the person. What kind of value system does this person have? What are his likes? What are his motivations? What are his desires and aspirations? Is he a quality person or not? Now, this makes a big difference as to this relationship here on this level. Another thing is the type of personality. Now, you can have two good people who are vastly different that'll just be poison if you get them close together. My dad used to use that word instead of poison. He said, just poison. Okay. You can take carbon and sulfur, two good elements, potassium nitrate, a good compound, nothing wrong with any of them, good. Put those three together in close proximity, stir them up, and jolt them a little bit, and boom, that's gunpowder. Formula for it, chemical formula for it. Now, what's wrong with the carbon and the sulfur? Nothing. It's interaction that happens in close proximity. You can take two good people, and their personalities may be just like that. It's not that one's good and one's bad, it's just that they're different. Thank the Lord he broke the mold after he made each one of us. He likes variety, see. And so the important thing you want to take into consideration here is to make proper allowance for individuality. Don't try to cram everybody in the same mold. Wouldn't that be a boring world? Thank the Lord that there is some individuality and some differences. Allowance for individuality. Quality of person, types of personality make a big difference. I had one dentist from a nearby city come a while back and had a lovely wife. In fact, he was a scamp in my estimation, but he said, sure, I love my wife. She's the mother of my children, and she's cooked my meals and all that. He said, sure, I love her, but he said, I just don't like her. Well, now, what he was trying to say to me was this, that they were so different, they were totally incompatible. Now, in spite of this, God can help us as Christian couples to live together peacefully, tolerate each other, if not enjoy each other once in a while. I mean, the grace of God can do a lot if we start letting it be appropriated. Now, our one problem is not a shortage of grace. It's our lack of proper appropriation. Personal appropriation is the problem. Okay, now, this is the problem with a lot of people. This person-to-person difference here. Some people just rub me the wrong way. Now, I pray for them, but I'd steer clear of them as much as I can. I think that's godly. I just don't like to be irritated, and they don't either. And I do something for them, and they do for me, and it's not the right something. And so it's just good sense not to ask for trouble. I'm not just going to go, just ask for it and stick my chin out. And that's stupid as well as other than spiritual, I'd say. All right, now, one step up from this here, we go to the gender. Now, this is the matter of male versus female. Now, this is where we're just persons. I suppose we'd be neuters, technically speaking, placed in either a feminine or a masculine body. Now, there's some theological implications there. I don't think I'm far wrong on. But I think, in a sense, spirit-wise, there's no masculine or feminine is what I'm getting at. Okay, up here. Here we're placing these bodies. Now, the point here is we're going to have to understand each other as men and women. Boy, that's a load. We live in a man's world and a woman's world, if you want to know the truth of it. Women think and feel and approach life and all this far differently than a man. She can see something that needs to be done and go in there and do it. Then the man comes along and says, why did you do that? Give me six reasons why. And she thinks, how illogical can you get? When you see a thing intuitively that needs to be done, do it. Why do you have to sit around cook up 17 reasons for why you did? There's no logic in that. So there's a lot of logic and intuition at times, and more times than what I'd like to admit, women have a discerning and sense in which they can see the heart of a matter many times when men are still piddling around on the outside just saying, well, let's figure it out. Anyway. Understanding each other. There are certain needs that women have, certain needs that men have. I feel just like I said. I want to say this just right. I think they're... I see the wheels turning in that room over there, and I know Lauren's going to listen to this one of these days. You're not fooling me. I'm too smart for the suckers. Now, I think that there's a possibility of women losing their identity in marriage. And one big reason why we see so many people in marital discord is the fact that women have become non-entities. They think all I need to do is just to worship him. That's the husband I'm thinking about right now. Do what he wants to do, get lost in all of this. And pretty soon life becomes very purposeless for them. They don't even feel the respect they should have for themselves as a person. Yes, 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 yes. Who wants a yes woman or a yes man? This isn't the right kind of reaction, and I'm sure this isn't the type that we promote here. But let me just say this much, that women oftentimes, wives oftentimes, lose their identity. They don't know who they are. They're the sum total of what everybody expects them to be. They don't know who they are. What is there in life for them? And I think every person has a birthright to become themselves, their best selves, to cultivate certain areas of their life that will enrich them. It's not just a 100% one way and nothing the other way, this kind of deal. And so right here we can lose our identity if we're not careful. But also we have to be careful of the roles we play. Uh-oh, I'm going to shut down fast now. I'm over time. It's costing the company. Anyway, some of the times we run into problems where a woman is playing the role of a man and a man the role of a woman. I remember distinctly one case I had. The great big hefty gal, she came in and she says, I'll tell you, she's talking to me by herself, I'll never let any man run over me. I believed her. She converted me. She said, my dad mistreated my mother, and I've decided I'll never let a man, you know, all that. And so in came the man then. He said, I'll tell you something. He said, my father mistreated my mother, and I decided I'd never mistreat my dear wife. Well, you see, I had double trouble here. You're a mealy-mouthed man and a feminine-type man and a masculine-type woman. Well, I don't think, apart from the grace of God, and then I think it'd strain it, I don't think that they're ever going to make it, frankly. They're mismatched. See, and really, if I understand women correctly, and I came up with four sisters, I guess that's why I'm in the work I'm in. A woman cannot love a man she can't respect. Respect antedates love. And a woman, underneath all of it, wants a man that will properly stand up to her. Now, I don't mean mistreat her or be unkind. But there's a point of security in being married as a woman to a man that you can look up to, that you can regard highly, respect and all. And there's this twist to it that too many times men don't realize. And they mealy-mouth around. And this isn't even what the woman wants in them. But this matter of switching roles, playing the wrong role, this kind of thing. Last thing here. This is husband, wife. We're getting down here, see, all under one roof here. Now, what we seek to do here is to achieve a oneness. Love is not just infatuation, attraction for each other physically. It may include that naturally. It's not just friendship, respect for, admiration for a person. But it's a strong desire to be one with that person. Now, this is what it takes to bring about a oneness, achieving a oneness. It's not a competitive something, it's a complementation. You complement each other, helping each other, and so forth. And so, actually, when we get to this level, we realize that this takes a lot of grace, a lot of gumption, whatever that is. I think that's good sense mixed with determination. And it takes a lot of practical living. And I think it takes all that we can do plus the grace of God to make life to what it ought to be and to enrich it and to be well-adjusted and to have a well-adjusted marriage. I'm going to just put a period there. I'm right up to my third point. Thank you a lot, and I'm sorry I rolled on here as long as I have.